You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. As well, you can hear these podcasts at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. There are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, which are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works, Volume 206 by Rudolf Steiner, 11 Lectures, translated by Matthew Barton, entitled A Human Being as Spiritual Being, Evolving Through the Course of History. This is Lecture 10, given in Dornach on the 19th of August, 1921. It is easier to understand the insights into humanity and the world we need to develop in anthroposophic spiritual science if we occupy ourselves with the way human outlooks have changed through the course of history. Those who hear today that in order to really gain knowledge about the human being, a quite different outlook is required from the ordinary one, will initially be surprised, and their surprise will momentarily lead them to dismiss this different way of knowing. People have the sense that one thing at least ought to remain immutable, this being the way in which they seek to comprehend things by mental effort. We see this especially in the views of certain modern historians who state that the soul condition of human beings must have more or less remained the same throughout history as it is today. If this were not so, it seems to them, no such thing as history could really exist. In elaborating an historical view of the past, they have to start from our modern state of soul and frame of mind. If, as historians, they had to look back to a form of humanity possessing a quite different soul nature, they believe this means they could not understand people of the past. They would not understand their speech and their actions. And historical thinking would therefore fail to penetrate the era of a humankind with this different soul state. In order to survey history, they think, human beings must basically have always been as they are today. But now you will easily understand that such a view is adapted to human convenience. If human beings have indeed developed a different state of soul during the course of history, then that means we also have to bring mobility into our ideas and concepts, must strive, in fact, to see other earlier epochs of history in a way different from our habitual way of understanding things nowadays. There is a very important example of someone who was compelled to accept such an alteration of the whole human state of soul due to finding it in some ways impossible to relate inwardly to the outlook of his contemporaries. This was Goethe. I refer to him today only by way of example. As a young man, Goethe had to find his way into the whole manner in which people around him viewed the world and human affairs. He really did not feel himself completely at home in this frame of mind, this outlook of his contemporaries. There is something tempestuous in the young Goethe, but this stormy nature is of a particular kind. You need only look at the poems of his youth, and you will find that he bears, in one side of his nature at least, a kind of inner opposition to what his contemporaries are thinking about the world and life. But there is, at the same time, something else living in him, something like an invocation of what lives in nature, which says more to him and of greater immutability than he can gather from the opinions of people around him. Goethe appeals to the revelations of nature, by contrast to human manifestations. And this is what gives his soul its fundamental tenor during his whole childhood already, and while he is studying in Leipzig and Strasbourg, then as he wanders about in Frankfurt, and also during his early Weimar period. We need only regard him as a child already, surrounded by the religious convictions of his contemporaries. But he tells this story himself. I have often cited this lovely image of the 7-year-old Goethe, who takes a music stand and places on it minerals that he has taken from his father's geology collection. then, placing a stick of incense on the stand, catches the rays of the sun in a magnifying glass, and succeeds in lighting the stick. Later, for of course he would not have put it like this as a 7-year-old, he says that he was bringing an offering to the great God of nature. We see him growing beyond what his contemporary surroundings can tell him, growing toward the natural world in which he seeks his refuge. Study Goethe's early works, and you will see that this state of soul is alive in him. Then he is seized by a great longing for Italy. And then, remarkably, we see how Goethe's whole mood of soul changes. Really, you can only understand Goethe if you pay heed to this mighty change that takes place in him as he arrives in Italy. You need only take what he says in letters to his friends in Weimar about the artworks he sees, which conjure before his mind's eye, EYE, the artistry of the ancient Greeks. He says this: "I suspect that the Greeks, when they created their works of art, worked according to the same laws that nature herself unfolds, which I am now trying to uncover." At last Goethe is happy with his surroundings, and he is so because he finds in them, he means within what surrounds him as art, a manifestation of views that are closer to nature than those he was able to discern around him in his youth. And then we see how in the course of his Italian journey there rises in him, out of this mood of soul, the idea of metamorphosis. We see how Goethe begins to regard the transformations of leaf into blossom in a way that grants him access to the idea of metamorphosis, the thought of transformation at work throughout nature. Only now does Goethe feel his soul to be truly at home in the world. And if we take everything that Goethe produced thereafter as poet and scientist, we cannot help saying that Goethe is living in ideas and concepts that are not easily comprehensible to his contemporaries, especially not to people in the modern era. Anyone who studies Goethe with all that modern education has furnished them with, from primary school through to the highest levels of education, with the habits of thought and habits of feeling they have acquired in this way, will actually fail to understand him. First, you have to inwardly recreate yourself in a certain way, if you are trying to gain insight into what Goethe actually intends when he rewrites his Iphigenia, which he first imbued with the Teutonic Nordic mood. In Italy, he rewrites it in the meter of the Greeks. You only understand Goethe in his whole stance toward his Faust after he has recreated his own soul in this way. All that Goethe had written of Faust before his Italian journey becomes inimical to him afterward. Subsequently, he could never have written verses such as, for instance, the one in which Faust turns away from the ascending and descending heavenly forces that pass each other, the golden pales, where Faust turns away from the macrocosm and says, quote, "You, the spirit of earth, are closer to me," close quote. That is the young Goethe. After 1790, Goethe would no longer have written this. When he takes up his Faust again at the end of the 1790s, the spirit of the earth is no longer closer to him. Rather, in the prologue in Heaven, he portrays the macrocosm. There he turns toward the very thing from which the Faust of his youth turned away, describing in fitting language how the heavenly powers rise and fall and pass each other, the golden pales. Here Goethe is no longer saying to himself, quote, "You, the spirit of earth, are closer to me," close quote, but rather, quote, "I only understand the human being when I do not pay heed to the spirit of the earth alone, but when I raise myself from the earth toward the heavenly realm," close quote. We could comprehend a great many other things, too, in the same way. For example, we could peruse the wonderfully composed treatise of 1790, Goethe's essay on the metamorphosis of plants, and would have to acknowledge that Goethe could never have written in such a way before his Italian journey, could never have used such a language that speaks with things themselves, that intrinsically expresses the growth and development of plants. And this points us significantly toward the connection of Goethe's soul with the whole of human evolution. Goethe felt himself alien to the trends of thought in his era, the moment he felt it necessary to assimilate the academic and scientific culture of his time. He sought a different mode of thinking, a different way of relating to the world. And he found this when, as it seemed to him, he had brought to life within him the nature of the Greeks, their relationship with the natural and human world. Goethe rejects modern physics because this is rooted in what he found alien to him in his youth. And such rejection is ultimately more honest than muted consent. Goethe could never entirely find his way into the worldview that humankind had made its own since the mid-15th century. In his youth, he opposed it. But after his Italian journey, he let it stand because he had found something else, another standpoint, by coming close to the Greeks. What was it, then, that lived in the general outlook, the view of life, that had arisen since the mid-15th century? What is Galileism, really? If you study Galileism, you find it to be something that seeks to make the world comprehensible in terms of measure, number, and weight, through reflection upon and observation of outward things. Goethe was never concerned with developing an outlook based on measure, number, and weight. But that is to see things only from one side. There is a certain correlate to what surfaces in people when they consider the world in terms of measure, number, and weight, and that is the abstract concept, mere intellectualism. We can see this very clearly. To the degree that the view of outward nature employs measure, number, and weight, from the first third or the middle of the 15th century onward, intellectualism arises in the inward life of the human soul, the tendency toward abstract thinking, the kind of thinking that primarily draws on reason. It is really only since the 15th century that we have elaborated concepts that testify to our great predilection for mathematics, geometry, mechanics. Goethe did not feel at home in this world, one aspect of which was measure, number, and weight, and the other aspect of which was intellectualism. The world to which he turned basically knew little as yet of measurable factors. If you study Pythagorean thought, you might easily succumb to the idea that it regards everything in the world as we do nowadays, in terms of measure, number, and weight. But there is a characteristic and telling difference. In Pythagorean thought, measure, number, and weight are employed and applied pictorially, in ways that are still, in a sense, entirely human, are still felt to be something not separate from the human being. Thus we can see that it does not work with measure, number, and weight as Galileism did later, from the 15th century onward. If, for instance, you study and read someone like John Scotus Origena in the 19th century, I spoke of him here recently in several lectures, you will find nothing in his works of what we are nowadays accustomed to as an edifice of the universe constructed from physics and chemistry. No sense of a hypothetical construction of the world's beginning and end from what we have learned through measure, number, and weight. In Scotus Origena, the human being has not yet grown so detached from himself and the outer world. He lives more in union with the outer world, is not yet striving for objectivity to the degree that people do today. And so we can see how Scotus Origena typifies what unfolded since the Greek era of Pythagoras, and then came to expression in later centuries. In that era, the human soul basically dwelt in quite different ideas, ones to which Goethe strove again out of the various subterranean currents of his soul life. But now we gain a sympathetic understanding of what is really at work in another, nowadays, little-regarded historical fact. I characterized one aspect of it in my book titled The Riddles of Philosophy, and today I want to look at another aspect of it. In the modern age, we must clearly distinguish between concept and word. It would do nothing but harm to human deliberation if we did not distinguish very precisely between what inheres in abstract reason and what lives in the word, in language. Abstract reason is, after all, also universal, a generally human attribute. The word lives in each separate language. So we can certainly make a distinction between what lives in the concept, the idea, and in the word. If we want to rightly understand our purely historical legacy from the Greeks, we will not do so if we assign this same distinction to them between concept and word. They did not distinguish to the same degree between concept or idea and word. When they spoke, what lives in the idea lived for them on the wings of the word. They believed they were filling the word with the concept. When they thought, they did not do so in an abstract intellectual way as we do. Through their soul passed something like the inaudible sound of the word. It sounded inaudibly in them. The word, not the abstract concept, was alive for them. In the era in which it would have felt unnatural to educate a certain portion of young people, as we educate our youth nowadays, things could be different. It is highly characteristic of our culture and civilization, although we ordinarily pay no heed to this, that a great portion of our young people are preoccupied with learning Latin, Greek, and, in quotes, dead languages from the age of 10 to the age of 18. Try to imagine a young Greek being so educated, having to learn, say, Egyptian and Chaldean. It would be inconceivable, completely inconceivable. The Greeks lived in their language, not only with their thinking, but rather language for them was thinking. Thinking was embodied in language itself. You might consider this a limitation of Greek culture, but it is a reality. And proper understanding of our legacy from the Greeks will depend on us recognizing this close affinity between concept, idea, and word, and how the word lived in the Greek soul as an inward, inaudible resonance. Certainly in such a state of soul, a Galilean perspective cannot be applied to the outer world in the way we do so according to measure, number, and weight. Measure, number, and weight, in a sense, lapse from us. You can say that there is only an external, symptomatic importance in the fact that what we nowadays present to every child as physics was felt in Greek times to be something wondrous. Various experiments we do today, whose results are calibrated in measure, number, and weight, were felt as magical back then. You can read about this in every history of physics. What we today call inorganic nature was something to which the Greeks related in a very different way. Given their state of soul, they could not approach it in such a way, and this was because they did not advance to abstract concepts as we now do in the Galilean era. If you live in the word as Greeks did, you cannot calculate the outcome of experiments in the way we do nowadays. Instead, you will observe nature's transformations. You observe what occurs not in the mineral, but primarily in the plant world. Just as there is a kind of affinity between the abstract concept and our view of the mineral world, so there is an affinity between the Greek relationship with the word and the apprehension of growth, life, and living transformation. When, with our mineral concepts, we reflect today on the beginning and end of the world and form hypotheses, these hypotheses are an image of what we have measured, counted, and weighed. Then we create a Kant-Laplace theory, or we form the idea of the heat death of the earth, of entropy and its final outcome. All these are abstractions which we draw forth from what we have measured, counted, and weighed. If, on the other hand, you study the cosmogonies of the Greeks, you will feel such ideas to be nourished by the way in which vegetation emerges in spring, how it dies away in the autumn, how it develops and fades. Just as we construct a system of the universe from our material concepts and observations, so the Greeks developed their system of the universe from an observation of what manifests in vegetation. The living realm was for them something from which their myths and cosmogonies sprang. With a degree of arrogance, those inculcated with a modern scientific outlook will say that this was all naive, and nowadays we have fortunately superseded such outmoded views. We have achieved such glorious things. They will regard what can be discovered by measuring, enumerating, and weighing as an absolute. Those, on the other hand, who are not blinkered in this way will see that our modern mentality arose from the Greek worldview, which drew its picture of the cosmos from the living realm. The outlook we now have has developed from this, bringing us intellectualism, which is, of course, also a means to educate humanity. But from this outlook of ours, founded on measuring, counting, and weighing, a different worldview will in turn arise. When Schiller overcame his early distaste of Goethe and became close to him, he wrote him a remarkable and characteristic letter that I have often cited. He wrote to him as follows: "If you had been born a Greek, or even an Italian, the world you seek would have lain everywhere around you in your youth." I am not quoting verbatim, but giving you the gist of it. Schiller felt how Goethe's soul inclined toward ancient Greek culture. Now, in the example of Goethe, we can in fact study how a mind altered as it found its way into Grecian outlooks. Today we are far more interested in this whole other way of relating to Greece than has been the case in the era since the 15th century. We can say that our age, living in the intellect and learning most about the world through it, insofar as this world can be measured, counted, and weighed, was preceded by another age that lived far less in the intellect than in a living soul life which still possessed an inner experience of the word, which, inwardly, heard non-audible tones. In the same way that we absorb a concept today, people in that former era had a living inward experience of the tone, the speech sound. Through this living quality of soul content, they primarily perceive the living realm. But we can go still further back, although then we will need to seek help from spiritual science, for ordinary history cannot take us back far enough. We can certainly remain within a view of history founded on spiritual psychology if we seek to understand the radical difference between the Greek soul and our own. But if we want to look further back in time, say before the 8th century BC, and gain a sense of the soul nature of people in those days, external history cannot help us. There are only scant documents from that time, and those we have are not appraised in the right way. In fact, we do have certain external documents, and rightly understood the title Iliad and the title Odyssey are among them. But they are not usually seen from this perspective. If we go further back, then, we find growing significance in a point of view that various people have entertained, most especially Herder, who gave utterance to it in an important intuition, but did not explore it in any rigorous academic way. This view is that before the civilized world lived in words, another era preceded this, in which it lived in images, pictures. But how does one live with language, for instance, and with the inward soul life manifest in it, in the image? One lives in pictures when the content of the speech sound, the quality that tinges it, one might say, is no longer so important. But when the rhythm of language comes to the fore, when the important thing is what I will call the shaping or configuring of the speech sound, the element which today we feel really as a distinct aspect of speech, when the poetic aspect of language is accentuated. Nowadays, a poet must first artistically shape language if art, if poetry, is to arise. But we look back to a time when the poetic shaping of language was a primary, natural, and self-evident thing in human nature, before speech and theoretical thinking had become as separate from each other as they did later, a time when people still saw something important in having a short syllable follow a long one. Two short syllables follow a long one. When they felt the importance of saying sequences of short syllables one after another. In this shaping of speech, something of cosmic secrets revealed itself to them. Something not revealed when we consider what tinges, what constitutes the content of speech sound qualities. There are a few people today who have a sense of this, who feel that speech emerged from this condition. We should pay heed to the intuitive feelings of such people who see through the confusing wealth of all that the modern scientific outlook presents us with and discern what I have now tried to describe to you in spiritual scientific terms. Benedetto Croce pointed in a very delightful way to this original, poetic, artistic element in language, which developed in human language in a prehistoric time, or at least in a time close to prehistory, before speech acquired its prosaic character. And thus we would have before us three epochs, you can say, the era that begins around the 15th century, which I will call the Galilean Age, with its inner intellectualism and its outer measuring, enumerating, and weighing of the world. Then a previous epoch, to which Goethe looked back longingly, and which, after his Italian journey, informed his whole life, where human beings live in an undivided unity of word and concept, not an intellectual life, but a soulful inward life, and outwardly the observation of living things, of what lives in transformation and metamorphosis. But then we can look back further to a third epoch preceding that one, where the human soul lived in something above and beyond language, in something that shaped and configured speech in a pictorial way. But what underlies speech sounds in the soul, living, as it were, through soulful instinct, this too discerns something in the external world. As I said, history has nothing to say of this. An historian can at most only gain an inkling of it, but anthroposophic, spiritual science can certainly discern it. This is the imaginative element in language, the instinctive, imaginative element that precedes experience of the word. And through this imaginative way of being, something still higher is now actually experienced in the outer natural world than can be experienced through the word or the concept. We know, don't we, that Oriental civilization, even today, when it has become entirely decadent, nevertheless points us back to earlier conditions that were full of vitality. We see this by studying the Vedas, for instance, or Vedantic philosophy, which points us back to ancient prehistoric eras. Something has remained from those times, something I would describe as an etheric quality, imbuing this whole Oriental state of soul. Something fairly alien to the Western frame of mind, something which, when we utter it in words, is already not the same. Something has remained, which, however deeply Schopenhauer may have felt it, can only be very distantly expressed by our word sympathy. This sympathy with things, this love in all creatures, which is still alive today in the Orient, points back to earlier eras when it was present in a keener, more intense form. At that time, it expressed how the soul could live into the feeling element. It is absolutely right to say that Oriental sympathy and compassion expresses a past, primal phenomenon of soul life that manifests in inward affinity with anything that itself feels, that itself has inward life, that does not only live as the plant does in metamorphosis, that does not only arise and fade, but shares in inward feeling in the experience of growth and fading. This feeling at first hand, the objective life of another creature's feeling, is actually only possible if we raise ourselves beyond concepts, beyond speech sound, or the content of words, to what lives in the imaginative configuring of language itself. When our experience of the word is as alive as it was for the ancient Greeks, we recreate the outward life of the plant. But we recreate not only the power of life, but the power of feeling. And what lies within it, when we have an inner receptivity, not only to language, but also to the artistic shaping and configuring of language. This is why it is such a grandiose thing when mythic poetry points us at certain moments to this primary phenomenon of soul life. When, for instance, we hear that at a certain moment Siegfried suddenly understood the language of the birds, which cannot utter human words, but can only create and configure soundscapes. But what splashes to the surface in bird song, like a fount of inner life, lives also in all life. It lives in everything that we cannot live our way into if we merely attend to the word, which locks up life in its little inward chamber of the soul. When we listen to words, you see, we listen to what someone else's head experiences. But when we inwardly encompass what lives in the imaginative configuring of speech from syllable to syllable, from word to word, from phrase to phrase, we do not merely grasp what lives in the other person's head, but what lives rather in their sensibility and soul. If we listen to what a person says to us, we hear the degree of their capacities. But if we can listen to the sound of their words, the rhythm of their words, the way they shape and configure speech, then we hear the whole human being. And in the same way that we hear the whole human being, so, likewise, if we raise ourselves to a grasp of the conceptless, wordless, shaping of speech sounds, which is inwardly experienced, not outwardly heard, we succeed in encompassing what feeling objectively inwardly experiences. And finding our way in turn by this means into a quite different state of soul, in which, alongside the speaking of word sounds, the soul also lived in rhythm, in pulse, in melody. Where all this lived in soul experience, we return to an ancient era prior to the Greeks. We return to an epoch in which human beings rose again from merely apprehending living metamorphosis to apprehending what lives in animality, in the feeling world, to a direct beholding of what lives in the feeling sentient world. If we look at human civilization, that is, the part of humanity of that era of which we are speaking, in the same way we would speak of the civilized world today, if we consider these peoples from the 8th millennium B.C. to roughly the 3rd millennium B.C., we find that the souls of these peoples were founded on a pictorial quality, an inclination, as I have described it, to apprehend everything as sentient. Our limited science and academic outlooks speak of the peoples of these eras as personifying nature, in quotes. Here, something hugely intellectual in the soul is superimposed on the actual conditions of those times. And compared with a child, say, who bumps into the corner of a table and gives it a whack because he personifies the table as alive, no one who thinks that a child personifies a table in this way, thinks it is a living entity, has any clue about the child's soul. The child sees the table the same way we do. It is just that he doesn't yet distinguish the table's nature from living things. And likewise, those ancient peoples did not personify either, but in their experience of the configuring power of speech, they experienced not only the nature of life, but also of sentience. Only by recognizing how human souls have evolved from, let us say, and we'll confine ourselves to this for now, the 3rd millennium B.C. to our own times, from the era of superlinguistic evolution, through the evolution of language, and into the age of intellectualism, from the era of an experience of objective feeling, through the experience of objective growth and development, to the sense of what lives in measure, number, and weight, will we more easily see the following. Bearing these evolutionary phases in mind, we will more easily acknowledge that today, when consciousness encompasses everything we need, if we are to penetrate the essential nature of things, also to find our way consciously into a new way of regarding the things around us, to believe that the condition of the human soul has never altered, but has remained always the same in the eras we have been primarily considering, is also to believe that this human condition of soul is something absolute, and that people will lose themselves entirely if this condition of soul were to change into another. But by recognizing that the course of humanity's evolution naturally involves transformations in our state of soul and frame of mind, we can more easily succeed in grasping the need to transform our souls so that now, in our modern era, we may penetrate into the essential nature of things, into the essential nature of the human being, into the essential nature of the relationship between the human being and the world. The end of Lecture 10.